have in front of us. These are the biblical affirmations. Each person is uniquely created in the image of God. That's where it begins, right? So, and that, who does that include? Everybody, right? And so that includes you and I. That includes the person who might struggle with gender dysphoria, right? They are an image bearer in some way. Their image bearing might be severely impacted by some of these things, but we are all uniquely image bearers created in the image of God. We all have dignity, and so we need to be attuned to that and cognizant of that. The next thing to have as a biblical affirmation is that our sex is a God-given gift. The sex that we have, the biological sex we have, is a God-given gift. And that, in a sense, goes without saying, but if your body is a gift, then every aspect of it is a gift. If God gives these things to us, then we should rejoice in the created goodness of our bodies. Sam Alberry, writing on this idea of transgenderism, said this, that our gender identity is not something we search for in our feelings, it's something we find in our body. And so that connects that embodiment idea, that it is something that is innate to us. Our sex is a God-given gift. What God gives is good and should not be changed. That's the next biblical affirmation. Where do we see that in Scripture? Well, we can go to James chapter 1, verse 17. Every good and perfect gift is from above. Oftentimes we think of that in terms of financial gifts or food or sleep or those sorts of things, but it extends outward beyond those things. I found a quote from Martin Luther. It's always interesting to see people writing on the topic of sort of the gift of our sex, removed 500 years from our present conversation, and this is what he says. He's writing on the estate of marriage, and he says, "I cannot make myself a woman, nor can you make yourself a man. We do not have that power, but we are exactly as he created us. I am a man, and you are a woman. Moreover, he wills to have his excellent handiwork honored as his divine creation, and not despised. That man is not to despise or scoff at the woman or her body, nor the woman the man, but each should honor the other's image and body as a divine and good creation that is well-pleasing unto God and himself." So I think it's just a beautiful summation of the reality of the changelessness of God's gift to us, but also its goodness to it, to us. So those are our biblical affirmations so far. We started with the idea that we are uniquely created in God's image. Our sex is a God-given gift, and what God gives is good and should not be changed. Two more before we get into some more ideas. First, it's the tragic loss of sin. I think as we look at the culture, as we look at transgender conversations, there should be a note of lament and deep sadness. Often, unhelpfully, our tone is one of mockery and laughter. Have you noticed that? Not necessarily within the church, but within wider conservative circles. Not naming any names, although we could. There are folks that seek to mock people struggling with transgender to sort of expose the futility of the worldview underneath it. Is the worldview futile underneath it? Absolutely. But it's actually a bit of a problem, and so we should tragically note the loss because of sin. And lastly, we shouldn't be surprised when people are confused about the world apart from God. That's, again, not rocket science, but think about this. Confusion is expected. A denial of God leads to a denial of nature. And that's a truism. That's a quote from a woman named Abigail Favalli that we'll talk about in a moment. But a denial of God leads to a denial of nature, which, again, not rocket science, but that should make sense. If we deny God, if we deny the truth of him, his creation, his nature that he gives us, there are going to be downstream consequences of that. So those are our biblical affirmations. Again, nothing new, but sometimes we need to reaffirm those truths so that we can enter into a conversation constructively. All right, how did we get here? How did we get to the point in our culture where there is this prevalence of transgenderism? What do you think? And I can keep talking. I realize I've got like 10 pages of single space notes, which is enough for 4 hours usually. So I'm happy to keep talking, and I probably will talk more than it'll be a little bit more lecture than discussion today. But what have you heard about how we got here? Or are you just like, I have no idea? Yeah.
I think it's relativism, and okay, whatever you think your truth is,
yeah,
is okay.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's a big picture thing. And again, I said I have a bunch of books up here. If you want to look at these afterwards, please do. This book will talk about some of that. in sort of the big epistemology, how did we get to the point where there's sort of a more relativistic understanding? Other ideas, thoughts?
I think it's an attack on the basics of society.
Okay, yeah.
It really is. It's almost to disrupt everything that is of value.
Yeah.
Traditionally in a Western Christian society, is not worth, is worthless.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think what you're highlighting there, Colin, is there are all kinds of different dynamics here, but one is the individual. Think of the 16-year-old, the 14-year-old who's just confused about who they are, right? That's one thing. And then there are larger sort of maybe societal conversations that are at play. So those both fit together, and there are maybe the same truth applied differently to those contexts. Yeah. Other thoughts? Yeah.
Are you familiar with the book Return of the Gods?
I've heard of it. I'm not familiar with it.
Okay.
Yeah.
I don't have an opinion either way on it, but his thesis is that as U.S. Culture has abandoned the worship of the one true God, the old pagan gods have been...
Yeah.
And so transgenderism is part of that as these old pagan gods work their way back into the U.S. culture because of the abandonment of the...
Interesting. Yeah, I haven't read the book, but I do know that statistically the rise in sort of pagan worship is increasing. Why? Because the naturalistic framework of the world is insufficient for us. We see its deficiencies, and we want there to be sort of transcendence beyond that. How that's connected to transcendence is a bit complex, but yeah. All right, that's helpful. And there are lots of ways we can go through. Yeah, Dave.
Somehow it seems to me that homosexuality has been a lead-in to transgenderism.
Yeah.
Because if you know people that are homosexual, or couples, invariably, I mean, two men are homosexuals, but one takes the role of the woman many times, and one takes the role of a man. Mm-hmm. And same way with women. One is more called butch or more masculine, and the other one is... And I'm wondering if some of that has contributed to, you know, the distinction.
Yeah. I think I don't know if you can draw a causal link between the two, both in terms of the chronology and most of the works that are those both indications of confusion around the givenness of our sex. Absolutely. Some of the causal links are maybe a little different, but yeah, that's a fair point. Partially because the best way to understand, and we'll walk through this in a moment here, the cause of transgenderism, so to speak, in a cultural setting, the understanding that makes it somewhat understandable for folks, stems back to the various waves of feminism. Now, feminism is a very large, amorphous term, right? When somebody says feminism, everybody is like ready to fight. Right? What do you mean by that? I'm a feminist. I'm not a feminist. This is great. This is terrible. So what is feminism? And we could spend the rest of our time going through the waves of feminism. I want to do it very quickly to help us understand where this comes from. Because what feminism does, especially in its second wave, is to separate sex and gender. And that becomes very important. When up until about the 1950s, the word gender had a predominantly grammatical meaning. And what I mean by that is, have you ever learned a language like French or an inflected language? Words have a gender, right? And it doesn't necessarily mean anything about the word, like a table can be gendered, and it's not like, oh, this is a masculine table. It's just sort of how the language conventions worked. And that was largely the usage of language, and sex was basically just a term for the biological reality as well as the various social implications of what it means to be a man or a woman. And so feminism initially, to some degree, hopefully, said there's a distinction here. Sometimes there are things, think of, you know, Victorian England, right? And they had a feminine ideal. And there were critiques of that saying that, you know, this ideal isn't inherent to the gender. And so they started sort of moving the category a little bit. And if we fast forward to third and fourth wave feminism, what happens is gender is entirely unmoored, unanchored from a sexual reality. And then that opens the door for there to be sort of a sense of your gender being irrespective of your embodiment. And so if we quickly trace maybe some of the waves here of feminism, the first wave, 1910-ish, is sort of the traditional feminism that we can largely celebrate much of what happened there. Think about property rights for women, the fact that women could actually have custody of their own children, the fact that women could vote. There were some very positive things that needed to be changed and happen. And so that happened around 1910, 1920, right? 1920 was when women got the right to vote in the United States. Canada beat us by 2 years, so there's that. So after sort of first wave feminism, there's this sort of pause and sort of feminist movements that's then resurge in the 1960s. And before then, and maybe you know this book, Simone de Beauvoir wrote the book The Second Sex, and her most memorable line from that book is this: "One is not born, but rather becomes a woman." Now think about that. Someone is not born, but becomes a woman. What does she mean by that? Are we like, I disagree, but why, or would I agree? What are your thoughts?
A woman learns to act like a woman.
Yeah.
And what is expected of her in society, and that sort of thing.
Yeah. And so that's very much her point, that in her view, there's a sort of an oppressive reality that taught a woman how to be a woman. One is not born, but rather becomes a woman. And so she's stressing this gendered aspect of what it means to be a woman. And so that is, it's interesting reading her. Maybe you know her, but she was Jean-Paul Sartre. I don't think they ever got married, but so a French existentialist.
Significant other,
yeah. And they had and she was very anti-children. She finally had a kid, and it was this big regret in her life, and very much. And in this move, when this happens, this view, what we see with these women is they want to eschew every aspect of sort of their feminineness and functionally operate as if they are a man in some of these second wave aspects of feminism. And I'm big broad brushstrokes today. There are many sort of aspects to this conversation, but that's part of what we see there. And so in this sort of intervening time before the second wave, there's this view that this author in her book says, that I just read, one is not born but rather becomes a woman. And that very much leads to the second wave feminism, which is more familiar to us. And another important book there is Betty Friedan's The Feminine Mystique. And she was really writing against sort of the discontented 1950s housewife and saying there's more to life than this, you know, getting your new can opener and being excited about it, right? There's more to life, right? And so on a certain level, like, we understand that, but at the same time, there is. I mean, I like a new can opener. I'm not going to lie. And so that was part of it, and it was an anti-essentialism. There isn't sort of something essential about being a woman. And so the end result of this, and again, we're going quickly, is sort of a nominal use of language. The category of woman is there, but it doesn't mean anything, right? There's nothing, a woman can define her own existence, right? And you can see maybe some of the social pressures they were moving towards, but it leads to this idea of sort of an existential expressivism that defines who you are. And if we fast forward to 1992, we see in Planned Parenthood versus Casey, some of this notable language, which was a case sort of defending abortion rights. It says this: at the heart of liberty is the right to define one's own concept of existence or meaning of the universe and of the mystery of the human life. And so this is, again, very quickly moving through things, but leads to this point where someone's existence and someone's understanding of who they are sexually and their gender is what they want to express it as. And so all that to say, what we've done is we've moved gender into this socially described construct and moved it away from our embodiment. And there are many aspects that happen in that thing. This is the rise of birth control, this is the rise of abortion, and all of these things. So your sexual expression can be moved away from some of the embodied realities that you have. Moving forward even further into the 1990s, we have the third wave feminism, and this is maybe some of the most radical forms. Judith Butler is the sort of heroine of this movement, and her idea is that gender is something that we do. It's a performative act. And so this is another sort of move in the conversation. And all of that to say, that's sort of where the main movements end. There's a little bit of a maybe another movement in the 2010s with the Me Too movement and some of those aspects. But to sum it up, what happened in all these shifts? The first shift, there's an erosion of bodily sex as referring to the whole person. Now sex is sort of just a part of your anatomy, not who you truly are. And the second result is the result of this new concept of gender. If you want to read 150-page I just tried to summarize 150 pages of this book very quickly. Her name is Abigail Favalli, The Genesis of Gender. I will say this book is excellent for the first 200 pages, and then it's really bad for 30 pages. She's Catholic, and nothing inherently terrible there, but her understanding of embodiment is very connected with Mary, and that comes out in the last 30 pages. The rest is just really good. She was a feminist English professor, converted to Catholicism. She was loosely Christian, had some evangelical upbringing, converted to Catholicism, and in her words, after teaching gender studies for like a decade, wanted to understand the worldview operating in the background, because it just wasn't making sense to her, the gender paradigm anymore. And it's an excellent book for the first 200 pages, and then it has some weird stuff. But it's not really necessary to understand the rest. That her real benefit is in explaining what I just tried to explain. And she does it much more eloquently than I can. And so that is sort of how we've got to this point where there is a gender category and then there is the understanding of our biological sex. Thoughts, questions, comments before we press on? Yeah.
Well, it's just so amazing how we as a culture and the world have accepted this, mm-hmm. taken it in, we're steeped in it. I read two articles in the same day. One was about these really bad orca whales who have been snatching the livers out of great white sharks.
Mm.
So it's like, well, I don't like a great white shark, and you know, but it was terrible and they were gonna have to do something about it.
Yeah.
The next article was there were a couple of orca whales, both males, that were having sex.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody was thrilled.
Right.
You know, it was like, so the culture is like, it seeped into every aspect of our reality.
Yeah. Yeah. No, and I think it's what's interesting is, you're absolutely right, it seeps in kind of everywhere. And I think it's always interesting to ask the question where we bought into this ideology without realizing it. Because I think we have probably subsumed more of it than we realize, and Favalli talks about mm-hmm. that in terms of sort of reproduction and some of those aspects where we think of reproduction as something we can sort of flip the switch on, right? And sort of there becomes this idea when there's a technology available to do something, it makes it normal and right. It's called a technological imperative, and sort of if we can do it, we should do it. And that begins to sort of seep into the way we think about it. Another guy who talks about this, he was writing in the 1970s as the UK was sort of dealing with some various health issues sort of as a nation. But he writes a little bit on what at that point was called transsexualism, which is now transgenderism. And his main point is that as soon as there's a surgery or a treatment to make something possible, air quotes possible, it normalizes it. For the culture, right? And so, can somebody change? I read a quote from Martin Luther at the very beginning, if you weren't here, and he says, I cannot make myself a woman, right? Writing in like 1518 or something, right? And everybody would say, yeah. And now people would say, well, no, that's not true, right? And so as soon as there's a technological thing, it moves the conversation to be able to justify it, which just gives us caution as we think through some of those dynamics for sure. Other thoughts?
You were talking about language at the beginning.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure how this fits in, but it seems to me it fits in somewhere.
Yeah.
In high school, I took German.
Okay.
And one of the hardest things was learning the articles.
Yeah.
Because the articles in German, you've got der, which is masculine, die, which is feminine, and das, which is neutral.
Right.
Yeah. And so that's one of the hard things to learn. of which one of those you apply. Because some are just inanimate objects that have these tied to them.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure where German has gone to now with it. Are they still using that?
Yeah,
that
I think those
designations or not.
In terms of the grammatical side of those things, languages have maintained it, but I don't think they're, there's no gendered reality behind those words, right? In terms of like the a noun taking a gender or whatever. But that's an interesting question. I haven't looked at in German particularly, but I've seen that idea referenced in the literature. But it's always as this is how we understood the term gender was just this grammatical thing. But there hasn't been really a connection to say that now we're going to change how the language works there. Although language as a general thing is very important, right? If you read anything in the transgender kind of movement, they police language very intentionally. Right, and it's known because they know, and I don't say this pejoratively, but they know that their framework of gender doesn't have anything that is grounding it, right? And that's where language becomes very important to them. A couple of hands, I think one here and one over there. Yeah.
Well, just building on what you said about the rise of technology and the possibility of people changing their sex.
Yeah.
I don't know how, if you've heard of this, but I heard a disturbing interview this past week about how transgenderism is morphing into transhumanism. About, and it's this same idea that we can, as we reject God and we depend on technology and medical advances, we can recreate ourselves to be not just man or woman, but anything you want to be.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was describing certain people who have had surgeries to alter their genitalia to resemble something like a flower or an abstract piece of art, or just changing their bodies to be neither man nor woman, just something totally, totally different.
Yeah, no, that's I haven't read specifically transgenderism connected to some of those kind of sexual conversation that you're describing from the interview, but transhumanism is definitely sort of the next frontier, right? And they can take the expression you're describing. It can also take the expression of, I want my kid to be 6'3", so let's modify his genes, and so that'll happen, right? And there have been examples of China, 2018, somebody worked on that to try to, that's becoming normal. And there's not a lot written on it yet. It reminds, right now it reminds me of, even like 10 years ago, there weren't a lot of good Christian books on transgenderism. I tried to find a good book on transhumanism from a Christian perspective. There's one. Like I asked around, asked some people, and there's one book, which is interesting, right? Because it's still new. But how do we respond to that? It's in a similar vein, I think, to transgenderism in terms of moving back to the giftedness of our body and the fact that our limits, because that's the other part of transhumanism, right? I'm going to work myself so I don't have to sleep. I don't need as much food. I'm taller. I'm stronger. I'm all these things, right? And I'm smarter. That's probably the biggest thing, right? And the ethics of that. So somebody can spend $15,000 on their kid's DNA, and they're going to be smarter, right? Do we sort of have these like smart people and these not smart people 100 years from now? Those are some of the conversations. And as Christians, our response has to be something along the lines of, our limits as God gave them to us are actually good, and we live as normal creatures. Long conversation though. Thanks for bringing that up. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's kind of going to tie into that.
Yeah.
I saw that thing. It was saying, like, God gave us grapes, but not wine. God gave us wheat, but not bread.
Right.
Like, he gave us the tools for us to then create. And they're truly putting themselves in the position of a God and comparing that to the good things he's given us.
Yeah. And I think that some of the language there, so this is, he used this guy, Oliver O'Donovan. He was an Anglican. He's still alive, but he's pretty old. Like in his 90s, I think now. Begotten, which is, we all agree 90s old, right? I'm not saying it, right, everybody? 90s old? Okay, 90s old. We can talk about 80s, 70s, 60s.
Not as old as it used to be.
Not as old as it used to be, but still old. Okay, we'll go with that.
Someday may not be old at all.
That's right. There you go.
Yeah.
Right. And in heaven, we said we'd all be 35, right? Yeah. So it's all good. But he used the language begotten or made, right? And he's playing on some confessional language there. But this idea of on one stance begetting, right, is normal. Making is abnormal, right? And so in that same sort of vein, like using God's created gifts is good, But when we pervert it from nature, that then becomes the moral quandary that we find ourselves in. We got about half an hour left. We got a lot of things we could note. One thing that's interesting is some people talk about gender and sex and all of this, and basically get to the point where they say we shouldn't use the word gender at all. We shouldn't use it at all. We should just get rid of the word gender. We should only use sort of sexual language. Interestingly enough, the people that sometimes do that are the people that are most invested in the sexual binary between male and female. And so it's radical feminism that will reject the idea of gender. Because what does it do? If anybody is a woman, then your whole feminism movement sort of doesn't have anything concrete with which to press back against the oppression that they are claiming. And so you have one idea that sort of gender is just sort of a construct, it's external, and therefore it's oppressive and it's artificial. The other side would say gender is sort of, it's innate to us. It's something that is necessary and it's liberating. And so you actually have sort of opposite sides of the spectrum pulling at the language from the same to towards the same end. All right, so let's look at some of the aspects of this fallout. And again, if you have specific questions, I'd love to chat. This is a really important topic. So aspects of all of this. The waves of feminism leading to this sort of bifurcation of sex and gender. One is that the view that women are oppressed by their bodies has become very normal. And that speaks to the abortion conversation, but just in general, that women are oppressed by their bodies. And that's very much part of this literature, that somehow a woman needs to escape their body to be a woman. That's an idea that's sort of baked into some of this conversation. And another thing that's interesting is this movement has actually led to the reinforcing of gender stereotypes. What do I mean by that? So the transgender movement, one of the ways that you identify somebody who is potentially struggling with gender dysphoria is if they're non-conforming to the gender stereotype. So what does that mean? Let's use an 8-year-old boy. What is an 8-year-old boy, what is he supposed to like?
Baseball.
What color is he supposed to like?
Black, blue,
right? Should he play with dolls?
No.
Right? Except for G.I. Joe, right? And G.I. Joe should probably not be a masculine, he should be a hyper-masculine G.I. Joe, right?
Action figures.
Right, and so we get this intuitively. And so what the transgender movement often will do is say if somebody doesn't conform to that, then they're clearly not that gender in their expression, right? And it's more, they'd make it more complicated than that, but that's sort of the general outlines of that. And what's interesting is, so they actually have a stronger view on some of their stereotypes. If you read Christian responses, and I found this probably at least 4 or 5 places, a lot of people say that one of the most helpful things we can do to respond to this as a church is to fully affirm that there is boys and there is girls, right? Fully affirm those categories. And at the same time, expand the boxes. What do I mean by that? Sometimes it's normal for an 8-year-old boy to play with a doll, right? I don't know if I should confess this, but I had 2 older sisters, and so I loved playing hockey when I was 8, and I loved my doll. And it was because I liked playing with my sisters and all those kind of things, right? And in another home, that could have been handled really poorly. And so we just need to be cognizant of that as we parent, as we grandparent, as we talk about these sorts of things. So keeping the full, and celebrating the goodness of being a boy and celebrating the goodness of being a girl. And that means when your daughter is really fast at running, you say, God made you fast and that's really great. And that sort of thing, affirming, and when your boy likes to bake, say, that's really good that you're using God's creative abilities to make food. Right, not to just sort of have no essentialism in the conversation, but make sure that we're willing to do that and to be aware of the fact that we are products of our culture. I read this week, and you might not believe me, but I can show you the sources on this. About 100 years ago, what did we dress babies in?
Dresses.
So the article I was reading had a picture of Franklin Roosevelt when he was six. And guess how long his hair was?
Yeah.
Long. And he was wearing lace. And he looked exactly like a girl. Mm-hmm. Like if you dressed him in that today, everybody would say, "You're such a cute little girl." Even, and I'm not being dismissive here, but we just need to be cognizant of the fact that we're shaped by this. Even the color pink and blue has switched. A long time, all babies were dressed in white. Why? Because you could bleach it. Really, like that's the sort of the theory. And so, you know, as time moved on, there was the ability to have other cleaning things, whatever. So we started putting our kids in colored garments. And in the, you know, 100 years ago, pink was considered a red color. And red was a strong color. And blue was a soft sort of pastel color. And so I don't, not to put tons and tons of stock into that, but just to have that in the back of your mind when we get so locked in on, when our fear radar goes up because something is this. Now, should we, going to scripture, right, we should dress intentionally as our gender, as that's understood, right? And what does a tie signify? Anybody wearing ties? We got one tie. I almost wore a tie today to make a point.
A male,
right? It's a signification and it of being a male. For about 150 years in history, there's this idea that if you're wearing a tie, it's clearly you are a man. And that's just part of the culture. Now that's, you know, you can hypothesize. Some people will say in 40 years, nobody's going to be wearing ties anymore. Heaven forbid, right? But these are just these aspects that we shouldn't get caught up in these minutia, but we should move to scripture and what it tells us about how God makes us in our sexual nature. 20 minutes to go. One thing to note is, so another fallout of this, this is sort of where we are in the conversation, is the idea that sex is a spectrum. If you heard that language. So now this is not talking about gender. It's talking about sex. And so they'll say there's male and there's female, but it's a spectrum, right? And so the language, maybe you've heard the language of intersex, and this is often a very, in sort of the trans literature, would be the gotcha card to say, well, what about transsexuals? Are intersexuals? And so what is an intersexual? And I know this is not a fun Sunday morning conversation. And if you want to read more, I'll point to some chapters that handle it very well. You need to talk about some of the details, but not really. So initially, there were some studies done that sort of said 1.7% of the population is intersex. And that's the number that often gets thrown about. And the problem with that, though, is how they define intersex is somebody who doesn't conform to sort of the platonic ideal of a gender, the platonic ideal of a gender. And so what they do is they include in that category, for example, there's a percentage of men that have XXY chromosomes. And so they would say that's an abnormality. And so you are intersex, you are other category. Another one is maybe women produce a high level of androgen and sort of have more hair and those sorts of things. They would say this is not the platonic ideal, you're intersex. And so it led to this idea that there's this third category. But if you actually look into the numbers and sort of look at this, even those people, like I said, a man who has XXY chromosomes could potentially live his entire life not knowing that he has that condition. It can affect your fertility, and so until he tries to have kids, he won't know that that's who he is. And so if you sort of remove those things and actually go to the level of there's something physically different in terms of the anatomy of the individual, you get down to 2 out of 10,000. So I say that just to say, if you're ever in a conversation, I don't know if you will be, but sometimes that intersex thing comes up. Those numbers are drastically overestimated as we actually move down to the list. And why is that? Because when you start out at the Platonic ideal, the idea of sex is sort of this broad brush whole thing of all these, how you look, all these things. But if we go down to sort of the biological level of saying, what is your body structured to produce in terms of reproduction? Is it sort of getting down to ova or sperm? What is it biologically set up to produce? When you define male and female sexually that way, that's where you get down to the 2 out of 100 or out of 10,000 exhibiting something that's different. And so the other thing that's kind of interesting is when the trans movement talks about intersex, it's very dehumanizing. They sort of say, here's this third category of people that we just sort of use for our political points, rather than saying there's some real odd parts of medical conditions through the fall that are really difficult for people to work through. And some of that is actually where the initial operations, to get into the weeds a little bit, happened. The first trans surgery was in 1930, a Danish surgery. It was a series of four surgeries. And long story short, the individual died after the last surgery, third or fourth surgery. I forget how far they went. But what's interesting is, so the initial moves, the idea was that this person wanted to be able to fully transition to the female sex and be able to reproduce. And that was the goal of the surgeries. Didn't work. Died. But then one of the next major things happened about the 1950s, and it was a hormonal shift. And so what's interesting is that the change was not so much in the second procedure about becoming an embodied woman, but looking like it. And so appearance becomes more important than maybe the actual chromosomal change that was maybe initially desired, or at least anatomical change that was initially desired. And that's where that idea of the technological idea comes in to the conversation. Thoughts, questions at this point?
Have they gotten to the point where they can change your chromosome makeup?
No. No, they can't do. They have not.
I mean, they can do a lot of things.
Yeah, and we can talk a little bit about some of the ways that they go about trying to modify this in a moment. Yeah. Any other questions?
Biologically.
Yeah.
Aren't there very rare, but aren't some babies born with both, sexual?
Yeah, ambiguous genitalia. To say yes.
Yeah.
Yes, and that would be that like 2 out of 10,000. Sort of situation, and those are the things where. But even on that level, sometimes there's a chromosomal
indicator,
right? And so it's very. I mean, I've read some of it. I don't want to be authoritative on it because it's very. They're super rare, and there's just not a lot of good literature on that. But even there, there's still like like if you take the wait and see approach, usually it becomes more obvious which gender they are. Does that make sense? Yeah.
A lot of times the parents are approached and say, you need to make a decision which way we're going to do
it. Yeah, and there's actually a case in the 1950s about that where the typical sort of twin deal, and some doctor convinced the parents to go along with sort of doing a transition on the one individual. It's a terrible story, and it's interesting though. It's I think his name's Mooney, John Mooney. If you've read anything about this, he's a fairly prominent guy. He's in my notes somewhere. Money, thank you, John Money. So he did this study, and there's the twins, and one twin sort of is transitioned, the other one isn't. And why this is important is, what do you think happened? I mean, later in life, it was terrible. The guy figured out what his parents had done and ended up dying, committing suicide. Mm-hmm. And I think his twin brother did a little bit longer after that. Mm-hmm. Why I bring this up, that's tragic. These things take a while to run out. So Money published his work, and it became sort of a foundational piece of literature in the scientific community. And then 30 years later, when it all falls apart, there isn't necessarily the redaction work done, right? And so these things, it takes a while for these things to run their cycle and to, I would argue, to see the natural consequence of the fall and God's common grace of restraining evil sort of run their course. It doesn't always happen immediately, but it does happen.
I've been curious what it's going to look like when this current course of thinking 30, 40, 50 years the next generation, what that rejection is going to look like, or then the next step of that.
Yeah.
like, what were those people thinking?
Well, I honestly think it's going to be a little bit of that. And so I think this is where having nations that are a little further along in the process is helpful. The UK is the most helpful case study. If you want to read a brief little article, Glenn Scrivener has written an article called No Trans Yes to Gay Marriage. And he's talking about, he's a UK pastor. And in that context, he's not advocating for gay marriage in the title, but he's just talking about the cultural phenomena in the UK that has increasingly sort of said no to the trans movement because of the things you're describing, or we've described here, the destructiveness of it. And their language is common sense. A UK prime minister a number of years ago sort of tried to use that language to, it was a last ditch effort to reclaim power kind of thing. He was on the way out. But he thought that there was actually enough cultural sort of cachet to move into that argument. Even J.K. Rowling, right? Maybe you remember her. She tweeted a number of years ago, and everybody, she's the author of the Harry Potter series, beloved children's author, right? Critiquing, not from a Christian perspective per se, but from a secular perspective, the trans movement saying it's not good for women was sort of her point. What happened? Cancel culture, right? We she's terrible. That started to shift. She's sort of being reclaimed. People are saying, I see what you were saying. Took me almost a decade, 5 years to figure out. But so there is a little bit of cultural movement. And that's because, I think we'll transition here, a lot of the explosiveness behind the transgender movement is because of what's called rapid onset gender dysphoria. And maybe this is sort of the more typical story, right, in terms of prevalence, where somebody very quickly, often in the US it's been sort of a teenage girl or boy, kind of comes and has this sudden experience of gender dysphoria, and that's been called rapid onset gender dysphoria. Lots of things to sort of trace that too, but some of it is because women are uncomfortable at that age in their body. And some of the best research is saying that part of the reason why these women are young girls, let's use that language, are attracted to transitioning is because they're reaching sexual maturity or puberty, and they're starting to realize that they are noticed by men and they don't like it. And so they retreat from sort of the hypersexualization of our culture by rejecting their sexuality as it's maturing. And that's part of the conversation. It's not all of the conversation. And then there's a host of social media aspects that sort of corroborate that idea. And there's, I hate to bring things up and not explain them, but there's one author, if you want to read her, she's Susan Bourdeau, who has talked about how historically, every few decades, there's sort of an aspect of the female body that is pathologized. And so she goes back to hysteria in the Victorian age and moves various things, especially talks about anorexia and bulimia and connects rapid onset gender dysphoria to that same phenomena. That a response to the bad things in culture means that women express something negatively with their bodies. And it's a really interesting bit of research. I'm not sure if she's a Christian or not, but it's an interesting piece of literature. So as we get close, what do we do? As we get to the close here, what do we do? What have we lost? Well, there's lament. We need to lament what's happened in this moment. Lament that there's a loss of women's dignity in this conversation, of celebrating the good givenness of the gender that God has given us. And we've also lost the idea of an ideal woman in our culture. Historically, there were ideal women, and they were usually mothers with kids and all of those things. And not to sort of play into a gender stereotype there, but we've lost some of that. Catholic writers will say we no longer have, they'll talk about the historic Madonna, and then they'll talk about the singer Madonna and say that that's an inversion of the feminine ideal, right? And I think there's something there. All right, so what do we do as believers? Well, very simply, we tell the truth. Our job, I think, is to tell a better story than this gender confusion. And that's not hard to do because we have Genesis. And so to actually lean into the givenness of gender, gender isn't something that is sort of manufactured, but it's something that we receive. and to be receptive to our bodies as God gave them to us is massively countercultural. And that's something that we can do with ourselves, but also with our children, our grandchildren, our friends, those sort of things. Abigail Favalli talks about a better rebellion. Gender ideology is a rebellion. She talks about a better rebellion, which is learning to see one's beauty and dignity as a woman amidst a culture that denies it. And I think that's really beautiful for both men and women to accept the beauty that we are given. Another few things. As we tell the truth of the story and our biblical affirmations that we began with, we also normalize the experience of the struggle. I think this is a normal thing that people will struggle with because of the cultural confusion. Our kids struggling with gender dysphoria is deeply sad. It's to be lamented. But we also want to know that our kids could actually come to us and say, I'm confused. I'm feeling this way. Help me. And we want to normalize the experience of struggle. Not celebrating the struggle, but normalizing it. I met a number of months ago a PCA pastor whose oldest son struggles with gender dysphoria. And he has done a really good job of being very clear with his son about what he believes and all those sorts of things. And one of the things that he has done in his very gracious, compassionate way of dealing with his son is not rejecting him, because part of the trans, I'm going to say conversion story, because that's sort of what it entails, is being rejected by your parents, right? In rapid onset gender dysphoria, a key part of the narrative, if you've really sort of paid your dues, it means your parents have rejected you. And this guy knows that, and he's told his son, I'm never rejecting you, because I'm never giving you that part of the story, because my story is better. And it's just a really beautiful way that he was able to do that. Another thing that we need to do as we tell the truth is to tell detransitioning stories. And as we do this, we avoid the gotcha, right? Because sometimes we're like, ha, here it is, right? No, we're going to avoid the gotcha mentality, that the sort of we were right all along. But helping people see the truth and see that detransitioning is becoming a bigger thing. It is a big thing. And so, what is detransitioning? It's somebody who has transitioned their gender, regrets it, and wants to come back to their embodied God-given gender. Now, this is what's really sad about this. That's not always possible, right? We'll talk about that in a moment. It's also important to note that there's this idea that when you transition, you become more happy, right? Long-term studies, especially in Sweden, has the best studies on this. It's not the case. Oftentimes, somebody, for example, if a woman goes on testosterone, they have a momentary brief period of sort of euphoria because they've got more energy and these sorts of things. But as that wears off, there are core issues of depression and those things that may have led them towards some of this transition in the first part are part of that. So be cognizant of that. Long-term studies don't actually show that there's an increase in happiness or a decrease in suicide. That's the other thing. Often that will be sort of thrown around. There is no studies that sort of show there's a decrease in suicide from folks, because the people that are pursuing transition are very, they're struggled. They're struggling. They're, damaged, all of that.
In regard to the suicide, though, one argument is that, well, that's only because it's so disapproved of in the United States that it drives that suicide.
Yeah.
Only that statistic holds in Sweden.
In Sweden.
It's been
socially
acceptable for years.
Yeah, which is why the Swiss study is, it's the earliest and longest and doesn't have that cultural negativity. So great observation. I'm going to go through these really, really quickly. So there's the difference between transitioning from just using language to actually medical transitioning. Part of the other thing to share in these transition stories is sometimes just like go on YouTube, find a few of them, because they're really heartbreaking in terms of how people express this. Medical malpractice is becoming the biggest strength towards sort of ending minor transitioning, right? Because why did the UK stop surgeries and now hormone blockers or puberty blockers? Because they were getting sued. Because people would say, I was transitioned and it was presented to me as the only viable option, and you didn't tell me I was going to be sterile for the rest of my life. Mm-hmm. You didn't tell me that I can't undo this. And so...
He always says that we're suing their parents for letting
us... Yeah, yeah, and that... I haven't seen... I'm sure there's probably some pending litigation there, but the big ones have been suing the medical providers, right? Because they, and this is, especially in the U.S., you'll see even some, I want to be careful what I'm saying here because I don't have the details perfect, but some of the sort of medical associations have sort of said, our job is not to assess whether or not you have this, our job is to affirm, right? For example, if you have ADHD and you go to the doctor, what do? They run tests. They do processes. They don't just write the script. And with this, it's just been sort of writing a script. And so there have been medical malpractice suits in the UK, and I'm sure we'll follow in other places as well. Interestingly enough, I was looking at this. So in 2014, Medicare removed a ban on transgender surgery, that they would actually cover it. However, in 2016, they, and you can go online and find this, it's still on the website, they basically have said, we have no national policy because there is no medical evidence to support that this actually works. And so they've left it to a state-by-state, case-by-case determination, which is a political move, right, to sort of leave it in that way, in my opinion. But they didn't come and say this is medically a good idea because the evidence doesn't support it. And so they weren't going to sort of put taxpayers' dollars behind it on a national level. And the other thing, just to be clear on, is when we talk about sort of the hormonal treatment, there's this idea that puberty blockers pause puberty. They don't pause puberty, they stop you from going through puberty, right? And also the other thing is, what are puberty blockers? What are they commonly used for? Anybody know? They're cancer drugs for prostate cancer and endometriosis. And so it's an off-label use of those drugs. And there are about three or four different ones that are used. And it's just interesting that the language there, it's sad that the language obfuscates the fact that there is no sort of coming back from these things after they've been on for a long period of time. All right, we got a minute left. What do we do? So we have two options. We can be outraged by this, or we can love those who are struggling with it. And maybe a mix of the two. So I was gonna spend some time on this. The PCA, we'll end on this. In January 21st of 2024, so this year, wrote a letter, and I'm gonna preface this by saying that this probably accomplished nothing. We wrote a letter to Joe Biden, Mike Johnson, Chuck Schumer, John Roberts, Hakeem Jeffers, and Mitch McConnell. Okay, so all the big dogs. We wrote a letter to them, and I don't know if it ever was read by them. But it says, "Dear leaders of the United States government," and it goes on for three pages. Basically what it is, it's an appeal to our heads of state to say, please outlaw medical transitioning of minors. This is dangerous. And so I commend it to you. Sure, you can always say, we should have said this or we should have said that. There's so many things that you could say. This was basically how this came about, is at General Assembly, which is our highest sort of board last year, we voted on this. And there were various drafts of letters on the floor, and it's 1,000 people. And finally we said, let's pick like 4 people and they write a good letter and we'll send that. And so this is the product of those 4 or 5 people writing this letter. And it's very clear, it's grounded in scripture, sort of saying this is what we believe to be true of us as embodied people. But I'm gonna read one paragraph that I think helpfully sums up some of the scientific reality that is a growing consensus, so it says this. However, experts disagree on the nature and cause of gender dysphoria. Persons who try to change their biological sex through the process of transitioning, including psychotherapy, lifelong hormonal treatments, and extensive non-genital and genital surgeries, are attempting the impossible. This reality merely reflects the divine design, as God created human beings distinctly male and female, cites a few verses. Since the sexual binary is noted in creation and determined by God, it cannot be changed. Therefore, it is not surprising that transition attempts carry many long-term risks. Among these risks, which are often irreversible, including conditions such as sterility, infertility, cancer, cardiovascular disease, strokes, blood clots, pituitary, apraxia, and diminished bone density. For children, these stakes are even higher. And it goes on to list some of these things. And so, if anybody wants the link to that, I can send you that, but you can find it online as well. And so I think what that letter does, and we didn't read all of that, but what it helpfully does is it correctly says that this is wrong. It's a bold letter, but it also is a deeply compassionate one, without shaming those who have been caught up in the midst of this. Think of, again, the 14-year-old who's just confused and has been presented with this worldview that is deficient. And so what do we say? Well, in conclusion, we can say that we are our bodies. And then we also need to affirm the goodness of our embodiedness. As people who are sexually created, we can rejoice that that is a good gift. And we need to consider, in a cultural moment like this, what type of victory we are after. Are we after a Darwinian victory of survival of the fittest? Or are we after a Christian victory that seeks to win the souls of people to the love of Christ? We can trust God in his word, and we can also trust that God's grace is a corrective force. As Thaxter noted, it's interesting to hypothesize where we'll be in 30 years. But the trend is that when you deviate too far from God's created norm, he, by his gracious goodness, pulls us towards what is right and good. Mm-hmm. If you mess too far with your bodily embodiment, bad things happen. And even those who don't believe in God will know that.
R.F.K. said that about Martin Luther King when he died, but he was quoting somebody from a long time ago, called
the long arc.
Awful grace.
God's awful grace, yeah. Yeah.
And, yeah, so it'll either be, it'll feel gracious or it'll feel awful, but it'll be grace nonetheless.
Yeah. Yeah, and we can see that. And I think in the midst of that, we can be those who invite people to a better story. I think you don't know what's going to happen, right? But it's very possible that, like, you know, 10 years from now, there can be somebody who transitioned and is converted. I mean, there are stories like this. I've read some of their narratives, and they just don't know what to do, right? Because they're sterile. They can't transition back. There's all these sorts of things. And so there are going to be broken people just like us that are going to need to be loved outrageously, even as we are bold, as that letter declares, and stand for what God has said is true. So let's pray. Father, thank you that your word is clear. Thank you that you are gracious with us. Lord, even as we lament what is wrong, we delight that you are a God who is gracious, that you are a God who cares about those who are lost, who are in need. Lord, would you allow us to care in the same way that you do? We ask in your name. Amen.
Thanks, Kevin.